You are listening to Expanding Horizons, the podcast of the Unitarian Church of South Australia, a home of progressive spirituality and free religious thought and action since 1854. Views expressed in these podcasts are those of the speaker and are not intended to represent the position of the church itself or of the worldwide Unitarian Universalist movement. For more information, visit unitariansa.org.au.
We call forth the life of our faith by igniting our chalice. This spark of new beginnings invites us into a sacred space to reflect where we have been and where we are going. I welcome you here today on behalf of the Unitarian Fellowship, which has been worshipping in South Australia since 1854 on Kaurna and Perimang lands. I'm currently the lay leader of this church, and my name is Jenny Dyster. Our services raise to worth ideas that are in accord with our seven principles, which are on the banner next to the organ there. Our third principle, acceptance of one another and encouragement to spiritual growth in our congregations, sums up the way we operate. We support people on the path they choose, any path that helps you see more clearly, love more abundantly, and work toward a better world for all. You're invited to join us after the service for coffee, tea, and conversation. And we're back singing again, so our first song is the Garden Song. There are words available, but they'll also be up on the screen if you prefer to keep your head up and your diaphragm expanded.
When Bethan started writing daily in January 2019, she knew she wanted to create a writing habit to improve as a writer. She had no idea that she would sustain it for a full year. This is what she had to say about habits. The reason to start off forming a positive habit in the first place is to reduce the necessity for willpower, and to do something without having to think about it too much. The new habit is just something you do. This is ideal when you want to sustain a new routine, such as exercise, eating well, studying regularly, and managing your money. The fact that habits are tricky to break is clearly a good thing if you want to maintain them, but for those things you want to change, breaking a bad habit is tough. The good thing and bad thing about habits are therefore the same. They are both hard to break. People typically list their bad habits as including smoking, swearing, drinking alcohol, biting their nails, and drinking too much coffee. Experts say that the best way to break a habit is, in fact, to replace it with a positive one, selecting something alternative to be or to do. In the words of Gandhi, your beliefs become your thoughts. Your thoughts become your words. Your words become your actions. Your actions become your habits. Your habits become your values. Your values become your destiny.
It's our tradition to share the significant events of our spiritual lives in an open forum of fellowship. I invite you now to deepen and bind that fellowship and covenant with one another by sharing with us any recent event that's been significant in your spiritual life, and mark that sharing by lighting a candle from our chalice and telling us briefly about it. As some things lie too deep for words, you're also welcome to light a candle in silence. And if you choose not to share, you can still take part in this widening circle of compassion by listening with an open heart and mind and refraining from comment. I open our worship space for this sacred act that draws us together in our shared humanity. The last candle is for those thoughts that remain silent in our hearts. Thank you. habit is the foundation of the routines that comprise the vast bulk of our everyday lives. When we're not disturbed, we live our practical lives without engaging in anything like a cautious inventory of what it is we're doing at each particular moment. No conscious deliberation is required to brew a morning cuppa or feed the pets or catch a bus. Habits are part of our everyday coping practices. Philosophers of mind and cognitive scientists alike often conceive of habits as highly mechanistic, near automatic responses to environmental cues that unfold outside our deliberate control, and habits can be counterproductive. Yesterday, for example, after coffee at Funk in Mount Barker, I began to take Jake, the border collie, to the supermarket car park instead of directly across the road to Gunhild's car, despite the fact I'd watched her pull up there 45 minutes before. We'd been sitting within 25 metres of it the whole time we had sipped our coffee and did the weekend quiz. She usually parks out the back. However, even our most mundane habitual routines often display a great deal of intelligence. They're often context-sensitive and flexible in a way that can support and structure our goals. Consider the example of driving the same route to work every morning. You might find yourself wrapped up in thoughts about how you're going to excuse something that you haven't done to your boss, or just wondering about what's going to happen today, and yet you easily navigate the roads that lead you to your destination. However, despite completing this task on something like autopilot, your drive will still be intelligently adjusted to situational factors like how fast or slow the driver in front of you is going, or when the traffic lights change. In attempting to account for the intelligent dimension of habit, researchers have moved from construing habits as unintelligent mechanisms toward modelling them as species of belief. But either way, they're still a bit of a puzzle. They have an intelligent dimension, but they can all often work against our intelligence and lead us astray. Constructing good habits is vital, but once a habitual routine is established, it's not in itself intelligent. So how smart or stupid are habits? Gilbert Ryle, who wrote The Concept of Mind back in 1949, which is 2 years before I was born, emphatically denied that habits were intelligent. He explicitly contrasts habitual doings with intelligent and skillful behaviours, claiming that it is of the essence of merely habitual practices that one's performance is a replica of its predecessors. Now, thinking of habits as unintelligent, a degradation of life, reducing spontaneity and vitality to a mechanical routine, has been held by many philosophers like Kant, Spinoza, and even today some researchers define habits as rigid patterns of behaviour that are automatically activated by context cues. Now, in a semi-autobiographical novel, Susan Mitchell makes great fun of the parents of a flatmate that she had in London. The parents were retired teachers, and they're still regulated by the time cues of their former workplace. Recess time, short lunch, and a habit of mind resistance to disturbance. Staying on an even keel is really important to them, no matter what happens. So as good as it gets is quite nice. Tower of London, quite nice. Punting at Cambridge, quite nice. Nothing excites them, but I digress. You could argue that seemingly intelligent habits, such as the habit of driving the same route to work every morning, which allows us to effectively reach our workplace even when we're lost in irrelevant thoughts, is not a habit at all, but a skill. And there's the rub. You can't really forge any clear-cut distinction between habits and skills. On one hand, many of our skills consist of habits. Skill acquisition in sport, for example, is a process of cultivating a new motor habit through repetitive practice. On the other hand, habits often comprise skills. Consider the habit of whistling when you're bored. This is a considerably skillful act. which can in some cases constitute genuine musical expertise. Keith Lamar Allsop drove his wife Ruth and daughter Maren nuts with his incessant whistling around the house. They were forced to admit the habit was lucrative, though, as he whistled for Irish Spring soap commercials and on soundtracks of about 50 films and music albums. But for just these reasons, introducing a clear-cut distinction between skill and habit, such that habitual doings cannot, by definition, be skilled or intelligent, is just wrong-headed. Now, in opposition to the mechanistic conception of habits, the philosopher Jason Stanley insists habits are intelligent because they're a kind of settled belief about ways of achieving particular goals. In my initial weeks at a new workplace, I will have developed a belief about how I could get to the office. Through my daily commute, this belief, he writes, gradually becomes entirely automatic and unconscious. At this stage, I don't need to consciously consider what route I should take, but I'm instead guided by an unconscious belief about how to successfully get there. As this unconscious belief becomes entrenched, it might also become recalcitrant to counter evidence. I might, for example, be accidentally informed that there's a better and quicker way to get to work. But even after I'm informed and sincerely convinced there's a more efficient route, I just revert to my habitual route. This intellectual view of habit, though, as a form of belief, also has serious problems in accounting for the intelligent aspects of our habitual doings. Habits are often context-sensitive and flexible. Emphasizing flexibility doesn't really square with the claim that habits are guided by stubborn, recalcitrant, unconscious beliefs. And anyway, how can unconscious neural processes even involve beliefs? Both mechanical and intellectual conceptions of habit encounter difficulties in explaining how habits can sustain intelligent behavior. Our everyday habits seem to be guided by perception and intuition. Just think about social distancing. Many of us proficiently maintain social distance automatically. When somebody in an elevator stands too close, you immediately perceive that and you provoke to step back to restore the right distance. Habits as reflexes amount to a treasure trove of possible responses to our environment. Our thoughts will almost always be suffused by habit. We shouldn't fall into easy dichotomies between intelligent voluntary processes on the one hand and unintelligent and automatic processes on the other. Our brain, after all, has different modes, doesn't it? Habitual and unconscious, and quick, or slow, conscious and reflective. But that picture's simplistic. While habits can distort our goals, they can also be context-sensitive. Perceptual skills play a pivotal role in guiding our habitual doings. By recognizing the flexible aspects of habits, we distance ourselves from the idea that intelligent action is always guided by specific intellectual processing. Socrates said the unexamined life is not worth living. You could, of course, argue that it's unreasonable to argue all unexamined lives are not worth living. For many, life in itself is worth living, whether it's examined or not, but let's leave that idea to another day. Introspection certainly helps us in our pursuit of wisdom and search for truth, and that includes dissecting our habits. It's pretty easy to distinguish between our good habits and our bad habits, and generally the list of the good ones is a bit shorter than the list of the bad ones. We could chat about identifying triggers and substituting good habits for bad, but I suspect you've already been there, or there's even more bad habits. Remember the 7 Habits of Effective People, who was published in 1989 and very popular in the 90s? It's been around for long enough for you to have read and digested, and I don't think you really come to church for tips on improving your health and career prospects. Instead, I'd like to link on the connection of habits with spiritual practice. I grew up at Lee Creek, and there was a significant subgroup of people who stood out from the other Adnyamatta folk. These were the descendants of the Kamaliyas, and they had surnames like Ahmat, or Akbar or Khan, as opposed to Mackenzie, Borawanga or Wilson. I knew vaguely about the Islamic connection because my father was a great admirer of the Imam at Mari, whom he credited as being more successful in passing on his values to young men than the Christian missionaries were. In particular, it was well known that the Islamic young men didn't drink. Recently, a book came into my hands from Lee Creek Community Library, and it's entitled Islam Dreaming. It contains many interviews with people who had Islamic fathers and Indigenous mothers. The Indigenous Muslim interviewees, Afghan and Malay descendants alike, discussed the emphasis on order, routine and punctuality. Shirley Wilson, who was an Akbar, claimed her father adhered very strictly to routines. Dad worked to a timetable. He did certain things on certain days and he was always there at certain times. You could set your clock by him and that's what he did and that's how we grew up. She noted that both her parents were very tidy people. We only lived in a tin shanty with dirt floors and lino on the floor, but it had to be washed and polished all the time. You had to be honest, you had to be clean, and you had to be hardworking. Members of the Binswani and Bindeman families noted that they had to be bathed by sunset every afternoon. As kids, if we didn't have a bath by 5 o'clock, we were punished. And that's to do with prayer time, one of their evening prayers. But we didn't know that. We just knew you had to be clean by 5. Later on, you work it out, and it's right on prayer time. And it was a huge thing not to be clean by 5. Even though the kids were generally not engaged in performing prayers, their households were arranged around Islamic rituals. Interestingly, there was a high incidence of Indigenous Muslim marriage. The author of the book, Peter Stevenson, speculates that Aboriginal women may have perceived Muslim men as good partners because they came from environments where order, routine and structure were highly valued. And the women were often brought up in a Christian mission, hence the cleanliness is next to godliness connection, a certain compatibility all due to valuing good habits, you might say. Now, for the fathers in such habits, the actions were rituals. Rituals are things you do to prepare for an action, whereas for the kids, it was all to do with habits, a habit being something done repeatedly for the purpose of performing the action itself. Having a bath is having a bath, that's it. As far as the kids were concerned, was for Dad, it was preparation for talking to God. So rituals, habits and routines all have to do with repetition. Predictability, they're soothing if you follow them, but they cause tension if you neglect them. They reduce the necessity of decision-making and hence angst. Our habits shape who we are, though forming positive habits isn't always easy. Habits shape our attitudes, actions, and decision-making abilities, and they affect every aspect of our lives. Habits are driven by reward-seeking mechanisms in the brain, and they're often triggered by something quite specific. Smell of coffee? Feeling stressed? Forming habits is the brain's way of being more efficient. As far as the brain is concerned, the more tasks you can complete without wasting time thinking about them, the better. And the main difference between a habit and a routine is awareness. Both are, after all, regular repeated actions, but while habits run on autopilot, routines are more intentional. And routines need deliberate practice. For example, a gratitude practice requires intention and effort. It won't run on autopilot. And the same goes for prayer or meditation. Our minds constantly analyse the environment for hints of where rewards are located, and any sign you're close to a reward triggers behavior, and as patterns build in the mind, cravings develop. Cravings are the motivation behind every habit. They give you a reason to act. However, what you're craving isn't the habit itself, but rather the change in state because of the relief that you get from following the habit. You crave a glass of wine, after all, for the feeling it gives you. You can also crave reflection or relaxation or mindful breathing because of the relief it brings without the effects of alcohol, which are sadly not always positive, especially as I get older. In the end, cravings stem from a desire to change your internal state. The response is the habit you perform. It can take the form of a thought or an action, and that is how you shape your spiritual practice. Responding depends on how motivated you are and how challenging it is to perform the behaviour. For instance, if an action requires more effort than you're willing to put in, you won't do it. That's why starting with a low bar is helpful. 2 minutes of mindfulness rather than 20 can be an effective starting point. The goal of every habit is the reward. The cue notices the reward, the craving wants the reward, and the response obtains the reward. We chase rewards for two reasons. They satisfy our cravings and they teach us which actions we should remember in future. Rob McPherson used to say during our annual month of spiritual practice development that it took 21 days to establish a new habit. Well, in a study run back in 2009, researchers at University College London found on average building habits takes around 66 days before behaviour change becomes automatic. However, the choice of habit was a major part of how long it actually took, and that ranged between 18 and 254 days. So I guess the point is, give yourself time and be patient with yourself. Avoid being too critical of yourself by practicing self-compassion and emotional regulation. And you remind yourself that habit formation and maintenance is a journey. Failure is a natural part of the journey. So don't beat yourself up and just focus on what future actions you can take. Avoiding temptation or controlling the environment, if you prefer. Setting the bar low enough is one way of putting it. Setting reasonable expectations for yourself is the more secular way of putting it. It's important not to be too focused on the outcome and to have faith that small changes will add up. We are, after all, in the business of living for the time being, so let's tread lightly and just keep chipping away at our less desirable habits and building up the better ones. And there are so many enjoyable ways to attend to our spiritual well-being. Prayer, meditation, and gratitude practice work very well for people with a naturally religious cast of mind, and that's sometimes due to their childhood. But for those of us with a more secular cast of mind, reading, exercise outdoors, walking, running, or singing and playing music might be much more effective. The path, after all, is for you to choose. We called forth the life of our faith by igniting our chalice. This spark of new beginnings invited us into a sacred space to reflect where we've been and where we're going. Knowing that this particular flame will end now, with our ritual extinguishing, we fear not its end, for we know with brave hearts that from every ending of our lives we are sent forth to make a new beginning.
Well, we hope you enjoyed this Expanding Horizons podcast. These podcasts are the intellectual property of the presenter. They can be used only with the express permission and appropriate acknowledgement of the presenter and the podcast used in its entirety. This permission can be obtained by emailing unitarianSA@bigpond.com. Please feel free to leave a comment or visit us on Facebook or Twitter by searching SA Unitarians.